So, this is the second half of your second class on understanding Brexits. And before we continue, I'm going to go back to Jeremy Corbyn in a moment. But before we continue, I just have a short video for you. I'm collecting a series of short videos so that I get a rest in class. Because, of course, one of the questions which came up very much in the referendum was the question of immigration. Now, historically, Britain has always been a place of immigration, as I'll be talking about later. But during its time in the European Union, the arrival in the European Union in 2004 of a series of countries from Eastern Europe led to quite large, high levels of Eastern European migration to Britain, in particularly Polish people. 500,000 Polish people came to Britain. Many of them were young people who came out of university and realised they could make more money working in a cafe in London than working as a teacher in Warsaw. This is literally true. And sometimes they stayed, and sometimes they stayed for a few years to get some money and then went back to Poland, even though it's cold in Poland as well. My mother, who is a very conservative lady, in fact loved the Polish immigrants. This is for a very simple reason, that before the arrival of the Poles, the Catholic churches were empty. And then the Polish arrived, and they're all Catholics, you know, so my mother was happy because the Catholic church was full. But that's not the most important question for most people. Don't send messages to people while I'm teaching, it's very dangerous. Can be. Okay, so this is a very short video about Polish immigration in one town in Britain over the last 10 years. If I can get the sound to work.
Welcome to Southampton, or as they say here.
Witamy Southampton.
Hyrule is originally from Pakistan, but his business is Polish supermarkets. For him, this 10-year anniversary is something to celebrate.
They're spending money. You know, they will go to a supermarket, they will use the transport, they will use the things, they will play lottery or whatever.
The first big wave of Polish immigration to Britain was after World War II. By the 50s, there are 162,000 Poles here. That figure had dropped to 58,000 by 2001. But when Britain opened its doors a decade ago, lots of Polish people wanted in. And today, there are 579,000 in this country, and 25,000 of them are in Southampton.
Polish beer, Polish sausage, Polish baby food. Across the road, you can get a Polish haircut. This is the very heart of Polish Southampton. When you pass someone in the street here, they're just as likely to say, Dzień dobry, as good afternoon.
Dzień dobry.
Dzień dobry.
Oh, you're Polish?
Yes, I am.
Dzień dobry.
Sorry?
I only know Dzień dobry.
How do you think the place has changed in the last 10 years? Look at the charity shops.
It's not really a problem. It's not caught in the right program. Polish people is, I think, is very good work.
You don't hear Polish in this office.
Good morning, Bossy Marketing. Thomas for him.
But Tom started his marketing business 4 years after arriving from Warsaw. He now employs six people, four of them are British.
When you come over to a different country, you will be having that mindset that you won't be treated as someone who is British. You will be treated slightly separately. And I think that's kind of has moved on a little bit now.
We Brits haven't yet embraced Polish food in the same way we have its people, but perhaps somewhere in Kairul's supermarket is the chicken tikka masala of tomorrow. Dominic Reynolds, James Factor. That's 5 News.
Okay, just a short little piece there. The two things, I don't know if you understood what he said right at the end. He said perhaps somewhere in this supermarket is the chicken tikka masala of tomorrow. And this is an important symbol, chicken tikka masala. What is it? It's an Indian dish adapted for the English. In Britain, there have always been, well, for 50 years, many, many, many Indian restaurants. In fact, the favourite British food is chicken tikka masala, which is an Indian, more or less, but adapted for the English. And so it became, in British politics, it became a symbol of multiculturalism. That the British favourite food, more popular than fish and chips, was chicken tikka masala. And so he says, perhaps some of this Polish food, I don't think so, our Polish food is not as good as Indian food, but perhaps some of this Polish food will become massively popular in the past. Okay, in the future. Okay, so let's get back to my slideshow, which is here. Because I had one more thing to say about Jeremy Corbyn, because I was mentioning that more than half of Labour members of Parliament are against him, and there has been the most incredible, when you have a big political crisis, you also have big libel campaigns and slander campaigns, the campagne de diffamation. And there has been the most incredible campaign against Jeremy Corbyn, accusing him of being anti-Semitic. Whereas Jeremy Corbyn has been involved in every campaign against anti-Semitism for 50 years. Yeah, it's the most amazing campaign. But the newspapers and the BBC, we say, oh, well, we think that Jeremy Corbyn might be anti-Semitic. It's very, very impressive. It's something un peu l'affaire de Dreyfus du 21e siècle. Really an incredible campaign against Jeremy Corbyn. If you search on the internet, Jeremy Corbyn, anti-Semitic, you will find 1,000 articles. And it's rather laughable, really. First of all, they said he was a Czech spy, c'est un espion Czech. On dirait que j'invente même pas. There was a campaign to say he was a Czech spy, and that didn't work. And then he was being accused of being anti-Semitic, and then he was accused of supporting paedophiles. But it's all an incredibly, because it's a big political crisis, there's this incredible campaign against Jeremy Corbyn to make him look unacceptable. So this caricature is actually quite gentle compared with some of the things that have been going on. So as the video pointed out, the question of immigration was one of the big questions in the referendum campaign. There are several aspects of this. Of course, when life is hard and unemployment is high, then there's always a section of the population saying, whose fault is this? It must be the Jews or the Muslims or the Pakistanis or the Poles or the Romanians. There's this scapegoat phenomenon which exists. And certainly the far right, the fascists, were hoping to make a lot of profit, political profit, from the Brexit campaign. And here you have a fascist demonstration. Yes, stop immigration and stop repatriation. Now, as you can see, it's very small. However, there have been far-right demonstrations of 2,000 or 3,000 people last week. Yeah? So there is something really happening there. Here is a cartoon about the question, how Brexit can be used with xenophobia. Yeah. And so there's certainly something very worrying. There's been a series of new racist organisations established, rather bizarre ones as well. There's one, the most well-known one is called the Football Lads Association, l'Association des Gars du Foot. Now, perhaps you know that in Britain football is extremely important, and there are large numbers of people go to football matches every week. And fascist organisations have always tried to organise among the people in the football stadiums. So that's one of the things that's going on. Now, this is not because of Brexit, but I think it was accelerated because of this campaign. You know, the far right would like to make the most of the situation. But you've also seen, since the referendum, a rise in the anti-racist movement. So here you have one of the biggest, Stand Up to Racism. That's the organisation is called Stand Up to Racism. And they have every time there is a Football Lads Association, there is also a counter demonstration by Stand Up to Racism, which is usually bigger, fortunately. And so there they are, no to racism, no to bigotry, no to UKIP, no to Islamophobia, no to war, no to lots of things. Yeah, and you can notice that it is supported by a lot of trade unions. These are trade unions. A lot of trade unions supporting it. In fact, most of the trade unions supporting it. And having some success at the Stand Up to Racism, they had a conference in London last month with hundreds and hundreds of people at the conference for all day. So that has had some success. The other new thing which has happened in the last few months is the campaign for a second referendum. Now, I was very surprised by this campaign because I saw the first demonstration a year ago, demonstration for a second referendum. And because I think I explained this last week, if the Conservative Party is against and the Labour Party is against, it's going to be a small campaign because that things work around the two parties. But in fact, it's much bigger than I thought. And they've managed to get quite a lot of people on a demonstration. They have been supported by the Liberal Democrats, which is a smaller party, who were in coalition in government with the Conservatives 10 years ago, approximately. I don't think they will be successful, but you never know. One of the arguments now is that some people are saying, we need a second referendum, but with a different question. Now, this is partly a question of legitimacy, because, of course, if you say, we need a second referendum with the same question, then people could say, well, why not a third referendum and a fourth and a fifth? You know, it's not logical. Whereas the argument, we need a second referendum with a different question, can be an argument. And here you have, this is what you have here, final say, décision finale. So what they would like is for there to be a referendum to approve or disapprove the final agreement with the European Union. This is not impossible. That is to say, if the crisis is so deep that Theresa May cannot find any other solution, she might call for another referendum. I think this is very unlikely because the leadership of the Conservative Party and the Labour Party agree on one thing. One of the problems that political parties have today is that many people think that politicians are all the same and they never listen to people and it's not real democracy. So if you have a referendum and then you throw away the results, then the idea that we are not living in a democracy could rise, and certainly the far right could profit from that quite considerably. But it's not impossible. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. I can't see it myself. More likely is another general election, and then Jeremy Corbyn might find himself as prime minister, which is with a major crisis on his hands, but there's already a major crisis, so we don't really know. But I don't think, well, it's still, it'd be interesting to watch, see what happens. Recent demonstration for a second referendum. Of course, it's mostly a crisis for Britain, but it's also a crisis for the European Union. Yes. Firstly, because quite naturally, some people in every country think, "Oh yes, not such a bad idea." And this is of course, they're all humorous cartoons as well. Yeah, Brexit, Grexit, Spexit, Portuguesit. Yeah, what is the word we can use for a campaign to leave the European Union? Korisishimasexit. That must be Turkish, I think. Now, for the moment, no other country's government has expressed a wish to leave the European Union. The most recent big crisis was in Greece 3 years ago, where it was very close. But for the moment, however, as I explained, if the European Union makes life too easy for the British to leave, they might encourage others. And so they have a kind of political need to punish the British government because they had this idea. So we'll see what they do with that. Let's see what the German economists were saying, that you know Brexit will be a terrible situation for the European Union. So what happens next? Well, what are the different options? Yeah, so as I said, the second referendum and deciding to remain in the European Union is an option. I think there's 1% possibility. It's so politically complicated that I really don't think that's going to happen. So the question is, once that they have Britain has left the European Union, what kind of relation will it have with the members of the European Union? This is the campaign for the second referendum, and as you can see, they did an online petition, and they got 4 million signatures for a second referendum. You know, if you have a petition, you get 4 million signatures. It's quite a popular idea. It's a little bit now. In theory, of course, the government could just ignore the referendum because in theory the referendum was consultative. It was not. It was not binding, but during the campaign, both sides says, "You, the people, are deciding. You, the people, are deciding." So after the referendum, it's politically rather difficult to do anything else. So there's a little joke about the referendum. Here you have two politicians. This is the Parliament. This is the Parliament. Here are two politicians, the House of Commons. Let's never ask the public for their views ever again. They're just depressed because it's so complicated. Okay, there's one cartoonist's response. And here is one of the complexities, which I already mentioned, which is that the tensions with Scotland are increased. There you have the Englishman imposing the barrier to keep European goods and people out, but the Scotsman behind him is just a moment. Yeah, I would like to go through and stay with Europe. Yeah, the thing left there. But the biggest political question at the moment is the question of Northern Ireland. Now, as you saw, Northern Ireland is quite small. But it is the central question for Brexit today because at the moment, the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland are both in the European Union. And so the border is like the border between France and Germany. You don't need your passport. You don't pay any tariffs if you're exporting something. It's an open border between the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland. However, when the United Kingdom is outside the European Union, this border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland should, in theory, be a real border, like an external border of the European Union, like when you go into Russia. Yeah, you leave. I don't know what the bordering countries are. When you go into Turkey, if I go to Turkey, I need a visa because it's not in the European Union for the moment. Now. That's rather inconvenient, but it's worse than that because historically this border has a very huge political importance. First of all, thousands and thousands of people cross the border every day. Yeah? People live here, they go to hospital at the other side, or they go to work on the other side. There's just complete integration because it's not really a different country. It's just a historical accident that the British kept hold of the north. But secondly, and so here you have the welcome to Northern Ireland and Brexit has stopped you at the border. But secondly, there's something else which is special about Northern Ireland, and that is that the south of Ireland would like Ireland to be united, just one island. And the north of Ireland is very divided. The population of the north are very divided. The majority, just about, would like to remain a part of the United Kingdom, but a big minority would like to have a United Ireland. And this division caused a civil war from 1968 to 1998. About 3,000 people were killed, thousands of bombs and buildings. There was more economic damage than people. 7,000 people were injured. The civil war in the north of Ireland. Now, the Irish are very humorous. They call this the Troubles, les Troubles. C'est une guerre civile, d'accord, une guerre civile de un peu assez long, mais quand même. And so, in 1997, they found a temporary solution to the civil war. The two sides, the military conflict stopped. It's very difficult to stop a military conflict once it started. And so the danger now is that if the border is re-established, it could theoretically increase the possibility of a new civil war in the north. It's not impossible. I will go into more history of Ireland later on in the semester, because we're going to talk about Ireland. But fundamentally, in Northern Ireland, you have about 60% Protestants, who are mostly the in previous centuries colonists from England and Scotland. And you have the poorer part of the population, 40% Catholics, who are the Irish who were already there. So let's say it's a post-colonial situation. Basically, it's an explosive situation. And this border, and the question of the border is for Brexit. It's not because of Ireland, but it's accidentally become more explosive. And even worse, when Theresa May held a general election last year and she lost some of her members of parliament, she no longer had a majority in parliament, and she needed a few more members of parliament from one of the small parties to help her have a majority. And she chose the Democratic Unionist Party, which is an anti-Catholic party from the north of Ireland. And so basically, the Conservative government of Theresa May depends on 10 members of parliament from a small party in Northern Ireland, which has a very strong political objection to any rapprochement with the Republic of Ireland. So it's just extra complications for Theresa May. I will be coming back to this in a moment. Here you get special status, no hard border. Yeah, so no hard border is the slogan. Yeah, we want to continue with the situation where we can cross the border. This is Sinn Féin, the Republicans. No borders in Ireland. Special status. Okay, now this question of Ireland is a little bit complicated, so I have another little video for you on it. I hope you will understand this. Some of their accents are rather Irish. So let's see what you can do with this. I have to make sure I found the right one. This one, yes. And the title is, Could Brexit Lead the Way to a United Ireland? This is a very long historical question. Ireland was united until 1919. Yeah, it was a colony of Britain. And normally, when you get decolonization, then the country becomes independent. But in this case, you had an exceptional situation where the British were successful in keeping part of Ireland. So Northern Ireland, which doesn't have any historic existence, was invented so that most of the industry and most of the Protestants were still part of the United Kingdom. Let's see if you can understand this this video. They're beautiful accents, but they can be a little difficult to understand.
This border would be hard. You need to be able to do that. I can help it.
Do you think that in our lifetime they would be able to
I think they're maybe.
Maybe. So you wouldn't have said that 10 years ago.
They were talking about a border poll, they were talking about joint authority, they were talking about Brexit, they need the United Ireland.
Mrs. Thatcher tells us that that Republic was a country in our province. We say, come on! Come on! Come on!
Marines or paratroopers will come out.
And it's so different. And I, as a child, when I was sitting in the back, turning that corner, we just turned, looking down this road, and just seeing maybe about 18 or 20 paratroopers, four or five OUC.
And that was the world we lived in.
And that was the world we lived in.
Yeah, but wasn't that food? Was he a saucy customer?
I hope not today. It hasn't been the only bit of sauce that I want to see in him at some point is barbecue. We're standing here early in the morning and you would have had at least three helicopters buzzing constantly. If they weren't ferrying supplies in or to another watchtower just in the distance, they were ferrying supplies to the watchtowers behind us. I firmly believe we're going to have a hard Brexit. I can't see how we're not, given where the Conservative Party in the UK is. It's very clear. You stick any kind of a hard border along that 300 mile stretch, you're saying to a sizable chunk of the population, young people here, that this country is being repositioned. It's going to cause us. And unfortunately, there are still people around who will want to
manipulate that.
Of course, absolutely.
This is a parade of the Orange Order, which is an anti-Catholic organisation in the north of Ireland.
It was dangerous. It was very intolerant. Do you think there's any danger we would go back to those days?
I would certainly hope not. But I think people have to be realistic about the situation here. There is a time of uncertainty for the future, and an uncertainty then, at least a vacuum. People are talking about a border poll, we're talking about joint authority, we're talking about Brexit, maybe the United Ireland. We have faced greater difficulties in the past. And we'll face these things in the future. But hopefully it won't be through balance.
What would the United Ireland mean to you?
I personally am a member of the United Kingdom. I'm a British citizen. I will remain always a British citizen.
Do you ever think, at the back of your thoughts, that eventually it's going to happen?
I think there's always a possibility there. But I have to say, I think those are defeatist attitudes. I've heard people recently say, surprised, they said, well, would it be any worse off? And I think that's what propaganda does. But hopefully the unions will see through those things and get back to where their first love is, not you know, the Queen of Commons.
Do you think that in our lifetime there will be a United Ireland?
I think there may be. I think it would be
something. You wouldn't have said that 10 years ago.
10 years ago, I would have thought that a United Ireland was a very distant possibility. Now I think it's a more real possibility. And the reason I believe that is that the economic interests of the people of both sides in Northern Ireland and both parts of Ireland are coming together rather than being divided. And I think that Brexit underlines the common interests that Irish people have as opposed to the interests of the Tory party in Britain.
What's interesting about this area is that Sinn Féin has been gaining support here, but that really has very little, if anything, to do with their campaign for United Ireland. It's about much more basic issues. The people around here really care about United Ireland.
Well, I suppose some people do, like in this area, the people are probably more like what? Oh, have no day to day rather than the United Ireland. They were first 280 miles away from the north, so on my day to day, they were affected by the affected children.
Do you agree?
Affected me.
Yes, sometimes the Irish accents can be a little difficult, yes. At the end there, it's interesting what they said at the end. Say Brexit must be organised in a way to have stability, because stability is good for reconciliation. So that's interesting. It's now 20 years since the end of the civil war, and there's still a need for reconciliation. So you can see the problem has not been solved. The situation today is better because there's no military campaign, but the problem is not solved. If you go to Derry or Belfast, you can still see on the walls KAT, kill all Tags, kill all Catholics. It's still a very, very, very hot situation today, yeah. In Belfast they have, well, I'll be talking about this later on in the year. In Belfast, in some parts of town, there is the Protestant street and the Catholic street, and between the two there is a gate which they close at 10 o'clock at night, and they open it at 9 o'clock in the morning, so that to stop violence. And they call this a peace wall, which I think is very amusing that they should call it a peace wall. It's more like a war wall. But lots more about that. But let's get back to Brexit for the time being. So from the point of view of Northern Ireland, you see, so the problem is this border. Theresa May said, oh, well, listen, let's make... one idea would be, let's have a kind of open border in Ireland and let Northern Ireland have a special status inside the customs union. And so the border, the customs border, would be between England and Northern Ireland. But this is politically very problematic because the Democratic Unionist Party, who want to stay with the United Kingdom, they will never accept that there should be a border between Northern Ireland and England. This is why there could be another general election, because Theresa May would be a happier lady if she didn't need these 10 members of parliament from the Democratic Unionist Party. But let's get back to the economics and stuff like that. The organisational side of this. Yeah, this is the explanation of the present political situation. After the general election in 2017, the Conservatives had 318 members of parliament. They lost 13. And the Labour Party won 30. But you can see the Conservatives are still in the lead. But 318 is not half. It's not half the parliament. And if you want to vote laws, you need half. You need a majority. And so where could they get... Also, they have another problem. The Scottish National Party is closer to Labour than to the Conservatives. The Liberal Democrats were not interested in a coalition because they had a coalition when they had 30 members of Parliament, and at the next election they lost half of them, so they're not so hard. So the Democratic Unionist Party with 10 members... They agreed with the Conservative Party, and there was a lot of money involved. I'm not talking about corruption directly, but the Conservative government said, in Northern Ireland, you want a lot of money for a new motorway, or I don't know if it was a motorway. So, oh, that's okay, no problem. Lots of money for all the important projects for your region. A lot of money, a huge amount of money. And as a result, they have this coalition where the Democratic Unionist Party agrees not to join, because if all of them together vote no confidence, then the government is defeated. And here you have the leader of the Democratic Unionist Party. It's a conservative party, religiously based conservative party. Really rather unusual. Half of their supporters believe in the literal truth of the Bible, that the world was created 4,000 years ago in 6 days. It's a very traditional... You don't see this much in Britain. It's more like an American phenomenon, really. But mostly it's an anti-Catholic outfit. So what does that leave us with? What are the different possibilities? The first possibility is a no-deal Brexit. That is, that there's no agreement, or there's no agreement on everything. And so, on the 1st of April next year, Britain is in the same situation as Turkey. Not Turkey, I should say Russia. that you know, there are tariffs, there is organisation and so on. Now, the Conservative government at the moment is preparing for a no-deal Brexit because they're obliged to prepare. Remember, it's quite complicated because after 40 years in the European Union, there are 500 different questions, you know, safety for milk products, and lots of little questions which are organised at a European level. And so the British government at the moment is producing hundreds of documents saying, you know, what is the situation about pharmaceuticals after, if there is no deal? Because at the moment, pharmaceuticals are dealt with and by something decided on a European level. Yeah, and so they are literally releasing hundreds of documents on very specific issues. What if there's a no deal? Now, this is not because they want a no deal, but the if you're negotiating, you're obliged not to show how desperate you are. That's part of negotiation. So one possibility is a no deal Brexit. This means that the United Kingdom leaves the European Union single market and trades under World Trade Organization rules, that is the same rules as you use for Russia. And the second rule there, I must admit, I need to study this a little bit because I don't really understand it. Yeah. Under World Trade Organization rules, each member must grant the same market access to all other members. Yeah, that you cannot discriminate between two countries who are both in the World Trade Organization. So you can't say, okay, 10% tariff for you and 15% for you. You can't do that. So that's the rules. A second possibility is what we sometimes call a soft Brexit. That means not changing too many things. Not changing too many things. For example, perhaps staying in the single market like Norway. Norway is not a member of the European Union, but they are in the single market. So that this is a theoretical possibility. It's politically complicated because half of the Conservative members of Parliament would not be happy. So, but it's a possibility. This I got yesterday from a German newspaper. Some commentators are sceptical about the possibilities of a positive outcome. Ça c'est marqué. Un Brexit bien régulé. What? Sorry, of course. Was it too fast? Yes. Okay. Yeah, that was rather fast. Yeah. Fundamentally, hard Brexit is breaking most of the rules which linked the United Kingdom with the European Union. Soft Brexit is keeping some of the present situation. And remember, the third option, which Jeremy Corbyn is talking about, is a people's Brexit, where the most important idea is not national interest. Because one of the difficulties with this discussion is that sometimes you get the impression that the interests of British business and the interest of British workers are identical, whereas in fact it's more complicated than that. If there is, as we saw, yeah, you will see this again, and I will put the slideshow up on the blog. So that those are two of the possibilities: a no deal Brexit or a soft Brexit. Although there are different kinds of soft Brexits. And here is an amusing German cartoon. It says, this is what an unregulated Brexit looks like. And this is what a regulated Brexit looks like. So you can see that they're not very optimistic about the future. Yes, that you have all these signs, you know, but you know, it doesn't really make any difference. So here is one of the options. One of the soft Brexit options is what you call the Norway option. That is doing the same thing as Norway does, but it's colder in Norway. Doing the same thing that Norway does, because Norway has free movement of goods, services, capitals, and people with the EU. It's not a member of the European Union, but you don't pay any tariffs. But the problem with it, the political problem with it, is that because they're not a member of the European Union, when they change the rules about, you know, agriculture, or the rules about fishing, or the rules about energy, or about electricity, or public services, Norway doesn't have a vote. Well, Norway doesn't have any influence on the European Parliament. Norway doesn't have any influence on the European Commission. The European Commission makes more decisions than the European Parliament. So this is a difficulty, especially politically, because the majority of the British population said we want more control. And in this option, they will have less control. So that's politically complicated. There's another problem as well, because of course, so Norway has this free movement. That's very generous of the European Union, isn't it? Do you think they ask for something in exchange? Of course. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Doesn't exist. An annual fee. Norway pays money to the European Union. Now, this is reasonable, because if the European Union is working hard organising the coordination and the rules and the safety regulations and the, you know, and so on, then, you know, if Norway wants to benefit from this, it's not surprising that they have to pay. But but of course the difficulty is that they don't worry about this, but they pay, but they don't get a part in the decision making. So that's going to be politically difficult. Also, another problem for Britain is that the Norway option does not include. Oh, sorry, not. It might not be a problem. It might be an advantage. The Norway option does not include free trade in food, or participation in European Union agricultural subsidies, or in the EU's regional policy. That you don't need to note all those details. That's detail. That's too many details. In any case, when it comes to exam time, you will have a very general question where you must give examples, but it doesn't matter which examples. I will not be asking you what was written on slide number 36. Okay. Right, so that's one option which, you know, would probably make many Remainers quite happy, because it's like keeping a lot of the old ideas. But it's politically very difficult, not so much because of the paying, but because, you know, it has no participation in this decision-making process. Another option, the Swiss option. Let's imagine we're Switzerland. We just imagined we were Norway. Now let's imagine we were Switzerland. Afterwards, there is the Japanese option, where we just leave. That is to say, to join the European Free Trade Association. Switzerland is not a member of the European Union, but they are a member of the European Free Trade Area. And this allows them some access to the single market. Now, you need to remember concretely what this means, access to the single market. Well, it means, for example, if a British company makes chairs, they can sell them to French hospitals, for example, and the French hospital cannot say, "Oh no, sorry, we prefer French chairs." They are obliged to give the British chair maker the same conditions as other companies, in particular public. So there's obviously a big advantage, and this is why Remainers are happy for Britain to pay quite a lot of money to have this access. It's an important thing. If Britain was to do like Switzerland, they would have less access to the single market beyond goods trade. That is to say, services would not really be included. But this is practically difficult, because goods and services are more and more integrated. It's very hard, especially when you buy a new computer, and then the software and the software support. What is goods and what is services? It's hard to say. The line is not so obvious anymore. Switzerland has free movement of goods, but for services, they have to make a treaty for every service. So Switzerland has a treaty with the EU, say insurance services. This is what we will do with insurance services. This is what we will do with banking service. This is what we will do with technical exchange, musical services, creative services, and so on. However, it's not so expensive. Switzerland also pays the European Union for this access, which is de bonne guerre, but it's not so expensive. So that could be an option. Of course, the difficulty is the European Union must agree. What's more, all 27 countries must agree. Oh my God. So it can be difficult to negotiate with the European Union because all 27 countries must agree. And we now have until the end of March. It's not looking great, to be frank. It's not looking great. It could explode. You may get 10 million British refugees coming to France. That's a joke. I don't think you will. But they would go to Spain. Yeah, that's the problem. Naturally, both the Norway option and the Swiss option would require agreements from EU negotiators. And right now, the EU negotiators are being rather hard. Theresa May went to Salzburg 10 days ago, and she talked to them. She says, "Oh, here is my plan. You know, what do you think? Could you say something encouraging, please? I have my party conference next week." Yeah. At the end of this week, it's the end of the Conservative Party conference. So, you know, Theresa May can do other things, you know. But this week, you know, what she needed was her friends in Europe to say, I think we will have a deal. I think we'll have a deal. Even if it was just words, because that would calm the party conference down. But that didn't happen. And in fact, the European Union, you go to set a, your suggestion is ridiculous. Okay. And so it was all not looking too good. And the preferred option of the government is the bespoke deal. Bespoke simply means fait main, quoi, fait mesure, sur mesure. Of course, the British government would like to have a made-to-measure deal, a special deal written, but they don't have one yet. And in fact, as I say, the different parties in Britain do not agree. The Conservative Party is divided inside itself. The Labour Party is divided inside itself. And I will give you the rest of the story next week. Thank you for listening.